Matt Redd will be studying from Deuteronomy chapter 23 this evening. The first question has to deal with those who were forbidden from entering the assembly of the Lord. What was the assembly of the Lord, and what classes of people were forbidden from entering it? Shahay, would you like to answer this question?
Eugene Merrill in the New American Commentary writes this, quote, "The assembly refers here to the formal gathering of the Lord's people as a community at festival occasions and other times of public worship, and not to the nation of Israel as a whole. This is clear from the occurrence of the verb enter throughout this passage, entering the assembly, a verb that suggests participation with the assembly and not initial introduction or conversion to it." I think probably the consensus of most commentaries is that assembly here, though the Hebrew word sometimes refers to all of the people of Israel, sometimes it's translated the congregation of Israel, is probably more precise than that in this passage and is referring to occasions where the people would assemble together for the Lord, and the expression of the Lord modifies assembly here. So these were probably times of worship, times where people would gather at the holy city for festivals, those occasions of the year where all the Israelites from around the world were commanded to come together. And that's probably what the assembly is here, though there is some debate about this, and perhaps others have some different suggestions. As far as the people who were disqualified from this assembly, we have a short list here. The first, those who were emasculated by some sort of incident. And it's not really clear whether this was to apply to every case, perhaps those who were emasculated accidentally, or maybe this is referring to those who did this intentionally. There is some historical evidence that self-mutilation was an element of certain pagan religions, and so perhaps that is the class of people this prohibition is targeting, those who have emasculated themselves in honor of some pagan deity, some foreign god. But it could be more generic than that and continue the message that we saw back in the book of Leviticus, that people that had certain bodily defects could not be priests, for example. And of course, the teaching here is that God demands absolute perfection on the part of those who come into the assembly. And the spiritual lesson, which carries over into the New Testament, is that God demands perfection in regards to sin and righteous living of all those who gather into his assembly. Not sinlessness, but those who are perfect, who've been washed in the blood of the Lamb. We also have here a second class that was excluded, those who were forbidden because of certain kinds of marital situations. This might refer to children of incest or mixed marriages in verse 2. And there's, again, some debate about this. And here you even see that the penalty continues on to the descendants under the 10th generation in verse number 2. And then in verse number 3, we have the Ammonites and the Moabites. And we remember that these were geographical neighbors of Israel, but the book of Genesis in chapter 19 tells us that these nations came about because of Lot's incestuous relationship with his two daughters, and that's how these nations came into the world. And so perhaps if incest is part of the forbidden marriages in verse number 2, then verse number 3 is giving us some examples, a practical application. Those who are descendants of incest, particularly the Ammonites and the Moabites, would be forbidden. And the 10th generation may mean forever, 10 being a perfect number in many occasions in the Old Testament. So these are a couple of the reasons why God has forbidden some from this assembly.
Thank you. Who else would like to talk about what the assembly is and those who couldn't go into it? Baylor?
Sure. I found, like Shai said, there's a pretty wide range of opinions. Keelan DeLitch maybe had the most extreme on the one end, saying that it's referring to exclusion from covenant fellowship of Israel with God And then on the other end, Jameson Fawcett Brown said it was just referring to admission to public honors or offices, an exalted position within the people. I think Shelley's right with the illegitimate children, the second part as well. That's strange etymology for that word. It's only found in one other place in Scripture, in Zechariah 9, verse 6. And then the connection with Ammon and Moab. But I thought it was interesting, and I don't know exactly how it worked in this, but Ruth was obviously a Moabitess. And obviously not only joined Israel, but ultimately became part of the line of Christ. So either this is specifying men, perhaps, or some commentators speculated to those who would not put off that old past and become a proselyte within Israel. But it is interesting that we have at least one very prominent case of a Moabite, or a person in this class who was not only accepted into Israel, but ultimately one of the most celebrated Israelites.
In the lineage of the Lord. Shai?
And I think Ruth answers the Keel and the Lich argument. This can't mean forbidden from the covenant, because Ruth would then obviously buck that rule. She was certainly accepted into the covenant people. She was a member of the nation and in the Lord's genealogy. But it may have been that Ruth was not able to go to the temple. We don't know, but maybe that was the case because of her heritage. But then you have the real challenge of what about her descendants? Obviously, Jesus went to the temple, and if the 10th generation means all generations. So there is some difficulty here, but I think that whatever the assembly was, maybe as Jameson Fawcett Brown and others suggest, high positions or leadership positions in Israel, Ruth has to fit somewhere into our interpretation, because she would clearly be an exception otherwise.
Well, I reckon David went to the temple and he was in a pretty high position too. So, you know, that opens up the idea of what was it? Israel was a theocracy, so you had high positions as well as the temple services. An interesting addition to that in, got the wrong chapter here, Nehemiah 13:1-3. On that day they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly, because they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. So it was, when they had heard the law, that they separated all the mixed multitude from Israel. So that sounds like it was more than just the assembly at the tabernacle too. Also, another interesting thing was the eunuch. So we think about the Ethiopian eunuch traveling to Jerusalem for a festival. So there's another interesting side note. Mark?
Yeah, I'm not sure about what you just read. That's interesting. I didn't read that. But Micah 2:5 says, it talks about sin and impurity, and it says, Therefore, you will have no one to determine boundaries by lot in the assembly of the Lord, Micah 2:5, which suggests that it is having to do with rulership, leadership, elders, that sort of thing. And so that's what I agree with Shahe. I think that's what it's talking about. I think the people could be part of the nation of Israel, but they were not allowed to be worshipers, or maybe even rulers. As far as the illegitimate children aspect, I think Jephthah tells us that it's not just children born out of wedlock, because Jephthah was a judge, but he was also illegitimate. So he was not only an Israelite and a worshiper in Israelite, but he was a judge in Israel. And so it's not just being illegitimate children. And I found a commentator that pointed that out and then said that what this is talking about is the children of cultic prostitution. So God is saying, because that's a topic in this chapter, God is saying that if you're a product of cultic, that's how I feel about cultic prostitution, that you're not allowed into the assembly of the Lord if you're a child of that union. So it's not dealing with general illegitimate children. And then, of course, we've noticed this before, but eunuchs, Isaiah gave eunuchs a special promise in Isaiah 56:3 that eunuchs who keep God's Sabbath, despite having some limitations, and keep hold of his covenant, God will give them a house and within his walls a place and a name better than sons and of daughters, an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. So obviously this is the hard and fast rule that we're being given here, but then there is some commentary that follows through the prophet.
Right. Yeah, this is an interesting set of scripture. Anybody else like to address it? All right, let's move on to question number 2. Why were Edomites and Egyptians treated differently than those discussed in the previous verses? Under what conditions could they enter the assembly? Bill, would you like this question?
Well, the first part there, the Edomites, that phrase, for he is your brother, that would be Esau, the beginning of the Edomites, and Esau was clearly Jacob's brother. And so the people of Israel and these Edomites were basically cousins in different ways. Note the command was to not abhor an Edomite, and Herod the Great was an Edomite. And certainly the leaders of Jerusalem, certainly Israel, abhorred Herod the Great and the atrocities that he committed. Egyptians, on the other hand, the phrase "you were an alien in his land," for 400 years Israel grew to a mighty nation while in Egypt, and so there was a certain amount of, strange as it may seem, a certain amount of gratitude to the Egyptians. And this idea, kind of the opposite of what we saw in that first group of verses with even till the 10th generation, and I think Shahi's right. I mean, that's a phrase referencing forever. I think the idea of this third generation is thought to truly be real. I think it really might be the third, after the third generation, that they could be part of the camp of Israel, but that's my opinion.
The great-grandchildren of the camp. Who else would like to address why Edomites and Egyptians were treated differently and under what conditions they could come into the assembly? Sean?
This is just a little speculative, but you read a scripture a moment ago that mentioned the mixed multitude. And we first read about this in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 38, when Moses says that a mixed multitude went up with the Israelites also. So there were some non-Hebrews, some non-descendants of Jacob, who left Egypt with God's people. We're not really told, at least the scripture that I couldn't find one, exactly who was included in this mixed multitude, but it's very plausible that some Egyptians, who were so amazed and impressed at the power of the God of Israel during the plagues, converted and went out of their devastated nation to follow these people who seemed to have some real power behind them. And so they went along. But we also learned in the book of Numbers that this mixed multitude became a problem because they were the chief among those who started to complain. So in one sense, they seem to be positive. They've gone out with God's people. In another sense, God's people. In another sense, they're chief instigators in some of the uprisings against Moses. So maybe Egyptians are included because there are some descendants of those people who came out of Egypt. Obviously, they were all dead, but the descendants are alive now. We're in the next generation. And Moses is addressing the people, and there are some of their children and grandchildren in this audience who are going to go with Israel across the Jordan to take the promised land. And he's making them a promise. He says the third generation, maybe one more generation after this, that those folks who are among Israel who have proven fidelity and faithfulness, generational faithfulness, can go all the way into the assembly of the Lord once the promised land has been captured and conquered and God's tabernacle is established in a more permanent location in another generation for that from now. So maybe that's those are the people that are under consideration here and why Egypt is treated a little more fairly.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. The third generation was the next one up for Egyptians. Bill?
Yeah, I just realized I failed to answer the second part of that question number two, under what conditions could they enter the assembly? And it's as Shaheh was talking in that area about being proselytized. I mean, being converted, so to speak. You know, I think that's the condition that's required here.
I saw some commentators speculate that it was, you know, enter the covenant by circumcision, but I didn't see anyone give a verse for that. Anybody else like to address this question? Taylor?
Yeah, I think it's just interesting to consider that within these two verses, Dad kind of hinted at it, but Moses is really overlooking several negative aspects of these people. Obviously, Egypt was the worst offender, enslaving and abusing Israel for who knows how long. But Edom, you know, Moab and Ammon are criticized in verse 4 for not meeting you with bread and water on the road, but Edom refused Israel's passage through their land, even when they asked, and went so far as to send out a force against Israel in Numbers 20. So it's interesting, you know, within God's plan, these two peoples are allowed, expected on the reason, but allowed entrance into the covenant, while others who did similar things to Israel are allowed or kept at arm's length forever. So it is interesting, God's providential insight within why these two were selected.
So the first part of the question that you were just addressing there, Taylor, about why they were treated differently, I think it might get back to a little bit about like what Bart was talking about a minute ago. There's a difference in the way that the people of Ammon and Moab attacked the Israelites. They seduced them, or they were part of the seduction through Balaam to get them involved in harlotry and idolatry. Whereas Edom and Egypt, it was just, we don't want you to come through here kind of thing. It wasn't didn't seem to be a attempt to seduce them into following other gods as much as what you had from Ammon and Moab. Another interesting idea is that verse that Shaheh read from Exodus, just two verses up from that, Exodus 12:36. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they granted them what they requested, thus they plundered the Egyptians. So they weren't to mistreat an Egyptian, but it was the Egyptian Pharaoh that had really mistreated Israel. It wasn't the people. You know, it was the people, for the most part. You know, it's, a lot of times you'll find there might be hostilities between governments and so forth, that the people are all right with each other. So it might have been one of those type of cases as well. All right, let's move on to question number three. Rather odd subject. What was the purpose of this ordinance? Hunter, would you like to address this question?
All right, so the purpose of this ordinance, I think it was summed up pretty well in verse 14. The Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore, your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. I think it was Keel and DeLitch, kind of their heading for this section was the preservation of the purity of the camp in time of war. So as far as keeping the camp clean. The general gist is that the bodily appearance, the way that they kept the camp physically, was to mirror the sacredness of God. The spiritual aspect of Israel's relationship with God and the congregation. Of course, this is referring to future war expeditions, not the time that they're traveling to Canaan. And then kind of miscellaneous, of course, verses 10 and 11 dealing with uncleanness. I thought verses 12 and 13 were really quite interesting. It's kind of a porta potty almost. When you go out, you dig and you cover it up. And of course, there's a sanitary perspective going on here. Don't want it just laying around, but again, it goes back to the spiritual aspect of mirroring the relationship with God.
Right. Yeah, probably the the real intent is to be holy for I am holy from Leviticus 20 and 1 Peter 1:16. Bart?
Yeah, we covered this before back in Leviticus 15, and it's, and I totally agree with, I think Hunter said it really well, and it's this idea of ritual purity versus moral purity. Neither of the activities mentioned here are morally sinful. Bodily discharges, which were covered in Leviticus 15, and there's a whole, we went through them arduously, those aren't morally impure. But God makes rules about those that he wanted the people under the Mosaic Covenant to obey. And if you disobey the laws, that's when you commit the sin. So, and I like the way, when I read this, it made me totally think of the Garden of Eden. Because God says, I'm walking among the camp, and here's my rules. And that was exactly the situation with Adam and Eve. God was walking in the cool of the garden with Adam and Eve. And he said, here's the only law I have for you, and that is don't eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. And that wasn't, it wasn't morally wrong to eat fruit. They could eat fruit from all the other trees. It was ritually, it was a ritual law that he gave them, and then if they sinned when they disobeyed. And that's the same idea here. There's nothing wrong with a nocturnal emission or not taking care of your bodily functions incorrectly. It's disobeying God. So God's basically saying, here's a situation just like Adam and Eve, and I want you to obey my laws. And the same thing applies to us sometimes. We don't understand why God says to do specific things the way he says to do them. And then people in the world, of course, they say, well, that doesn't matter, obviously, and they just do whatever they want. But it matters to God.
Bill?
And to go off of that and jump a little bit ahead to the next chapter, verse 14, the word that's used for unclean thing, that you may see no unclean thing among you, is erwat, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which means indecency, nakedness, shameful exposure. There are a lot of different definitions and a lot of contention about how it's used in Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, especially as it pertains to marriage. But as Bart just said, within this section, this context, there's nothing moral at play, but this presence of these issues within the camp showed a lack of reverence or respect to God. How that impacts what we see in Deuteronomy 24, we can talk about when we get there. But I did think it was interesting that this word is used right before in an amoral context.
Sorry?
I actually think these are some of the more powerful verses that we've seen so far in the book of Deuteronomy for this reason. If you've ever been around a bunch of military veterans, you may notice that oftentimes, I don't mean to overly stereotype, but they use pretty vulgar speech and they like to tell coarse jokes that many of us would not be comfortable hearing or telling ourselves. And that's been my experience, spending time with people who have served in the Army or other branches of the military. And so this reminder from God, hey, even when you're out with the guys preparing for battle, when you're out fitting for war, you're in the camp of the Army, even there, I am in the midst. I am with you. I'm watching you. As Proverbs 15:3 says, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, watching the evil and the good. And so even in a place like that, where you're far from the holy city, you're far from the tabernacle, you're far from your wives and your mothers who might tell you what you're doing is inappropriate, even in situations like that, God's standard of purity must be kept. And that's a powerful message for us who think that once we're away from this building and we're not around other Christians who might call us out for saying something inappropriate or doing something inappropriate, even when we're in the far-flung places that we may go, even there, God's demands for purity must be met.
And what these guys did reflected on Israel. Got to move on to the next question. Question number 4, how does the protection for runaway slaves differ from the typical way nations have handled this scenario? Trace?
To sum up an answer for this, this ordinance was to ensure protection of the slaves, not the oppression of the slaves. And I mean, as we all know in history, slavery has never been really a good thing. It was good on slaves. Slaves were never really protected so much in any situation. So what God is doing is ensuring their protection. And despite what, you know, critics would say that the Bible would do the opposite of that. But some good verses are, I would say, in Exodus 22, verse 21. It says, you shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt, so referring to Egypt again. And then I have one in Proverbs 22:22. It says, do not rob the poor because he is poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate. So.
Thank you. We also would like to address how this protection of runaway slaves differs from the typical way nations have handled this scenario. There was a different scenario for all the other nations in this area. Shahi?
Yeah, in most ancient, maybe all ancient Near Eastern law codes that we have today, harboring runaway slaves was generally a capital crime. It certainly was in the Code of Hammurabi. In ancient Hittite law, there was a monetary reward that was offered for returning runaway slaves. So generally speaking, in any culture that's had some system of slavery, runaway slaves were punished, and anyone who harbored them, they were punished as well. And that's very common, not only in the ancient world, but even in the very different kind of slavery and New World slavery that was common in this country some time ago. That was typically the law in those sorts of situations as well. So that's been generally the accepted practice throughout the world. Israel standing in very stark contrast. I thought there was an interesting connection here to verse 14. I discovered this in this study. In verse 14, Hunter read, that God was in the camp to deliver Israel. And the word deliver there is the same word for escape concerning the slave here in our verses. And so the play on words is that God was with Israel to deliver them, and Israel should be with the slave to deliver the slave. So what's presumed here is that a slave who is running away, we've talked about the circumstances whereby someone could become a slave in Israel. Usually it was someone who, because of poverty or debt, sells themselves to a term into slavery, and they work that term. If their master is cruel and beats them, they are permitted to leave. They don't have to stay in that situation. And so the protection that the neighbor offers the runaway slave is the same protection God offers his army. The same idea. And this has been a theme throughout Deuteronomy, that God expects Israel to treat each other and to treat others just like he treats them. And the same kind of blessings, the same kind of protection, the same kind of love, the same kind of generosity he bestows on them, even though they don't deserve it, they're to bestow on others, even a runaway slave.
Very good. We need to move on. Question number 5. What does the phrase "the price of a dog" mean? Lance, would you like to answer this?
Sure. From what I read, this has to do with the prostitutes and whoremasters. We also see this written about in Revelation 22:15, I guess alluded to. Barnes says, it's the wicked, the depraved, the vile, such characters that are dogs or unclean animals among the Jews. This might be the profits that they get from these prostitutes, the price of the dog.
Yes. Thank you. Who else would like to address what the price of a dog means? Bart?
Yeah, so the answer, I agree with what Lance said. The answer is found in verse 17. Verse 18 is just replicating what verse 17 says. No ritual harlot in verse 17, or perverted one of the sons, so no male or female prostitutes. And then you will not bring the wages of a harlot or the price of a dog. And so the price of a dog is the wages of a male prostitute. And again, this kind of gets back to this idea that no illegitimate child of the cult prostitution was allowed into the leadership or the worship. God was against this foul, ancient, you know, concept of prostitution. And we don't have any idea now what it was like in all of the ancient nations of the world. You know, they sold their children into prostitution. And Babylon, Herodotus tells us that every woman in Babylon was required to be a cultic prostitute at least once in her life in ancient Babylon. And, you know, so it was endemic in the ancient cultures. And so God is saying through this that this is not, obviously, said many other places, but it is not to be allowed. You're not to bring the money from this. In no way is it associated with God's worship.
Kaufman, I like Kaufman's point, that he pointed out that these were probably some of the most successful evangelists for paganism, was the prostitution rings this time. Bill?
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. I remember reading that. Something else I read is kind of disturbing. 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 12. King Isaiah taking away the Sodomites and the idols from the land. So, you know, despite all this, here's Israel. 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 7. King Josiah, and he broke down the houses of the Sodomites that were near the house of the Lord. So this was a problem they would fight.
Right. So another thing besides just what was the dogma was, as we've been talking about, what it meant to put that money in the treasury. I think, you know, if we think about Ephesians 6:12, what we fight against is the, you know, the powers of darkness and evil and wickedness. And this, if that money entered the treasury, that was a mixing of pure and evil together. Also, another interesting tie-in, I think, is Matthew 27:6. This is where the priest would not put the money from that they paid Judas in the temple treasury. So, you know, they connected that evil that was done for murder, they couldn't put it in the treasury. Anybody else before we move on? Let's move on to the last question. How do these rules elaborate on the general prohibition of the eighth commandment, you shall not steal? Dennis?
Basically, I think these rules were a safeguard against someone selfishly hoarding or taking more than they needed, but being allowed to eat your fill really took care of an immediate need, assuring that no one would go away hungry. However, if that person starts taking some for later, it becomes stealing. I thought about going to the Golden Corral with a cooler.
Golden Corral with a cooler. I thought about somebody rolling your combine into your field and get a little red. Taylor?
Yeah, in verses 21 to 23, you're talking about free will vows that are made. So something that someone didn't even have to vow, but volunteered. And so to go off what Dennis said, I think the idea here is twofold, stealing from your neighbor, but then also in 21 and 23, stealing from God. And Malachi 3:8 uses that same connection of robbing God by withholding what is his. So I think that's the connection here.
Yeah, when you made a vow, it's no longer yours. It's you've stolen it if you fail to pay it. But Ecclesiastes 5:5, better not to vow than to vow and not pay. We also would like to address how this is an elaboration on the eighth commandment, you shall not steal. Chris?
Well, I was just going to say, Jesus and his disciples went through the field and picked grain and ate it as an example to this. So,
right.
So we can see that.
Yeah, that they didn't take the cooler with it.
Or a sickle.
So, and another aspect, it's, I think Dennis kind of touched on that, that, you know, you're eating the grain, you don't take for tomorrow, you're relying on what God's providing right then and there. It's a different scenario than hoarding, taking the neighbor's stuff to provide for yourself.